from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. The great literary classics are more than merely important works of art, says author Kevin Smokler. Books that have stood the test of time should also provide insight into how to live a great life. In his new book, Practical Classics, Smokler advocates rereading those often assigned tomes like Candide, Huckleberry Finn, and I Know Why the Cagebird Sings. We'll talk with Smokler, and we want to hear from you. What makes a book worthy of revisiting? And what book have you reread that was a different and better experience for you? Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. What books are worth rereading and which books can you especially benefit from with a reread? Kevin Smokler joins us this hour. He's the editor of Bookmark Now, writing in Unreaderly Times, and his writing has appeared in the LA Times, Fast Company, the San Francisco Chronicle, and The Believer. He recently published Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School. Joins us for this Forum Hour, and welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. And you are a man who has said in print that you were reading since before you could crawl. Is that a fact, actually?
Oh, absolutely. I grew up in an enormous house in Ann Arbor. I should say a house that felt enormous because of all the books leering from the walls. It was enormous when I was 2 and 3 years old, and I was pulling books off the shelf and hitting myself in the head.
Well, you're lucky you didn't have a Howard's End, you know, where books all come crashing down.
Yeah.
You have sort of an operating thesis here that there are a lot of books that are assigned, canonical books we call them, in high school particularly, mm-hmm. and even in college, that may not have the original thrill that they would have later on, reading them at a maybe more mature phase of one's life. That's sort of your operating thesis.
Absolutely. I think a book... A classic is a bit like an old friend. On the one hand, it feels like not a moment has passed when you pick them up again. And on the other hand, you have changed immeasurably. The book hasn't changed, but in some way you can measure your own change against it.
Yeah, I like your metaphor. It's sort of like finding something imprisoned in amber.
Yeah. The book hasn't changed a bit, but you can hold it up to the light and see how different you look in its reflection.
And books change with age. I mean, you know, Hamlet is not the same play that you read when you're 17 years old that you might read later on in your 40s or 50s. But you decide, I mean, the decision to take the text that you took, to work with here was based somewhat on high school syllabi, I guess, but College Board List and... AP English and Clifton Fadiman, Harold Bloom. You went to a lot of sources.
I did. I probably had 100 books to choose from before I whittled it down to 50. And I also wanted to make sure that there were books from a couple of generations before me that might have been read by my parents and grandparents in high school, and then more by kids in high school now and in recent years. It was important to me that Practical Classics not act as though time had stopped when I graduated from high school. That felt arrogant and non-generous to readers to me.
We were thinking of maybe even doing a program on The Great Gatsby because it's out now as a 3D film. Buzz mm-hmm. Luhrmann's put it out. And, you know, it's one of those books as a longtime teacher of literature that, you know, I've gone back to time after time, and maybe too many times. But the fact is it reads differently every time. And that's the truth about many of the books that you write about here, isn't it?
Oh, indeed. Just in the case of The Great Gatsby, you know, I think of those immortal last pages. And when I reread it, I said to myself, what teenager is going to understand the resignation we have that time passes and we can't get things back, and when things are gone, they're gone? I remember being 14 years old and thinking a year was an eternity and time would stretch on forever.
Well, I remember Nick's last words, too, when he said, you know, it's my 30th birthday. I'm too old to lie to myself at 30. And when you hit 30, you kind of think that makes sense. But when you're 17, or 18, 30 seems a far, far cry from where you are.
Absolutely.
Kafka's The Trial ends with the 30th birthday, too, of Joseph K., who gets stabbed on his 30th birthday. I've always found those kind of riveting about turning 30. But let's start and talk about some of the books that you talk about.
Sure.
I mean, you talk about growing up and maturing. Huckleberry Finn is a wonderful example of that. And it seems to serve you in a way that many of these books serve you. I mean, you talk about the struggles that have gone on between Toni Morrison and Jane Smiley, you know, defending or attacking Huckleberry Finn. But it not only serves adolescents and should serve them, but it serves us looking back at our adolescence. And the same is true about a book that you said was the hardest for you to write about and revisit, which was Catcher in the Rye.
Absolutely. In the case of Huck Finn, I remembered the context of that book completely wrong. I was pretty sure that Huck Finn was published like on the day Lee surrendered at Appomattox, that it was somehow a comment on the ending of slavery in the Civil War. And it certainly is. But it came out 2 decades after the Civil War was over. And Mark Twain was 50 years old by that time and was talking about a period a half century before of his own childhood. And so I think, and if you hold it up against Tom Sawyer, you realize Tom Sawyer is mostly a book about whitewashed fences and trading blue tickets with your friends and treasure hunts. And Huck Finn is a book about human bondage and fathers that beat you when you get drunk, when they get drunk. And so
And witnessing one's own funeral.
And witnessing one's own funeral. It's a real darkness in Huck Finn. And I think given how much time had passed from when Huck is alive and when Huck Finn, the novel, came into the world, I feel like it's saying we have all grown up, including this nation, and we are, in fact, better for it. So Huck Finn, to me, was as much about acknowledging what we learn and the richness of maturity as it was about the nostalgia of adolescence.
That's also lighting out for the territory, and I'm reminded also of a great American literary critic named Leslie Fiedler, who said,
sure.
It's really about homoeroticism, you know, between a man of color and a white boy naked to the waist. And when Jim says, come back to the raft, talk, honey, that's all you need to know. But there's, a sense of trying to recapture your own past when you go back to these books, when you revisit them. And, it may be futile on the one hand, even though, like Gatsby says, can't repeat the past. Of course you can. But there's a way of finding entrance or a portal into the past, isn't there?
Yes, at least a reconciliation with your past and an acceptance of what it was and a gratefulness for what you've become. I was fortunate that I got to address my entire high school. The very first promotional, I'm using air quotes here, thing I did for this book was I was the featured speaker at the annual writing awards at my high school. And that was definitely, on the surface, a life list item where I got to check off returning in triumph to one's high school as a grown-up. But more than that, I really got the sense of how much my high school, which was only 20 years old when I was there, had grown and mature, how much I had, how many great teachers were still there, how much larger the educational mission was. And I was able to say, my God, it wasn't just that these were mean old oppressive adults when I was 16 years old. In fact, these were hardworking educators doing their best with me, and I was just one kid who passed through, and they were living their own history the same time I was. It was a really wonderful feeling.
Our guest is Kevin Smokler, and his new essay collection is called Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School. You early on talk about the autobiography of Malcolm X, and it is written for the most part by Alex Haley, but you were kind of prompted to revisit it by Studio 360, the public radio American Icon series. And yet when you read a book like the autobiography of Malcolm X, suddenly it takes on a different shape years later because Manning Marable's biography of Malcolm X, because of Spike Lee's film, so forth. I mean, there's a different transformative nature to the way the book affects you.
Yes, I was very fortunate in writing that essay that Manning Marable's biography had just been awarded the Pulitzer Prize when I was writing it. So the autobiography was in all sorts of reconsiderations. There was a great article by Alex Gopnik in The New Yorker about it. And I was able to sort of see it as not just a book I sort of gulped down as supplementary material to the film biography, which is what I did back in high school, but also a book very much about a person. I probably reread the last chapter of Malcolm X 5 times in this particular rereading. And I realized that this was definitely a person very much in transformation, as he had seen himself throughout his entire life. And had he lived, we probably would have seen 16 more versions of Malcolm X before he had shuffled off this mortal coil.
He went from Detroit Red to Malcolm X to the El Hajj and all these
exactly.
It was a metamorphosis, really. But what I was struck by in your response to Malcolm X, to the autobiography, was meeting Shorty, you know. And there again, you know, one looks back at one's adolescence and thinks, this is my buddy and so forth. And you meet somebody later on, as Malcolm did with Shorty, don't even know what to say to him at that point in your life, or you don't even know how to communicate to him.
Yeah, there is always a risk of sadness in revisiting your past, that some things you can revisit and have a handshake with and say, wow, it's really like no time has passed and we have something to give to each other here in the present. Sometimes you have the same handshake and you can say, well, we really don't.
You know, most of the great classics, especially American classics, are about loss.
Oh, yeah.
They really are, as far as the central theme in them. And I was surprised when you said your favorite of them all was Boys of the Band.
And the band played on.
I'm thinking, you know, you even say yourself, Randy Schiltz was not a brilliant stylist, which I would agree with as much as I loved him. But, you know, every time you go back to it, you're awakened again, you say.
I sure am. Of course, for very personal reasons, that book was largely responsible with bringing me to San Francisco. That book was responsible for my interest in narrative nonfiction. And it was the book that got me back into reading when I was 20 and I was convinced that, you know, no one was ever going to make me read anything that I didn't have to again, which was just an adolescent bout of silliness that I had. But you're absolutely right. I don't think he was the most brilliant prose stylist. In fact, sometimes you read And the Band Played On and it feels like being hit with a hammer thrown across the room at you. But I really...
You still could appreciate it in a different way
each
time.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I think when I first read it, I appreciated the anger of it. And then after that, I appreciated the depth of research. And then after that, I appreciated the sadness in how we were witnessing an entire generation, not only of San Franciscans, but of Americans lost to us. Back to that loss theme you suggested earlier.
You know, books do have quite an effect on you. When you were writing about the Bell Jar, you said you felt slapped by a stranger. And kind of an interesting observation, might get some calls on this in terms of if this resonates with people, but the idea that Jack Kerouac and On the Road is for boys and The Bell Jar somehow is for girls. And that's a very telling remark on your part. You're saying sort of the girls identify with maybe the imprisonment and boys with the open road, and there's a vast gender difference right in that.
I certainly can't take credit for that. A number of writers have pointed that out, and I was probably just recycling that quote from somewhere. But yeah, I do think there is a sense. I remember reading On the Road as an adolescent and feeling like, you know, every time I got in the car with my newly minted permit, there was a whole America waiting out there for me. And that was a really neat feeling. And I didn't read The Bell Jar. Lots of people I knew in high school read The Bell Jar, but it was not assigned to me. It was a book that I danced around in high school. But
you
really
said you read because Sylvia and Esther wanted to live. What do you mean by that?
I was convinced that it was because it was Sylvia Plath's only novel and I knew what had happened to her, that it would have a kind of defeatist rainy day quality to it. And in fact, the book is like trying to break out of its own prison. It is fiercely and blindingly alive.
Except in the beginning when she tries to write like Salinger. I mean, it's a very different book in the beginning, but then it becomes, of course, darker. And
oh, yeah. You can almost feel the book throwing a switch and becoming something else.
And you write about books of love and pain. You have a whole section on that. Include Pride and Prejudice and tell us that, again, Austen novels are mainly read by men. But men should read them. Why should men read them?
Nobody told me that Jane Austen was as funny as she was. I picked up Pride and Prejudice, and I was chuckling a good portion of the way through that book, and I tried to put it in context, and I realized, along with Shakespeare, Jane Austen is the godmother of British comedy. You know, Jane Austen's theory is that one of the funniest situations human beings find themselves in is trying to maintain their dignity when they're with another person they find attractive. And I thought, my God, you know, throw Jane Austen forward in time and you have Charlie Chaplin and Monty Python and Mr. Bean in The Office. And that is really what about our brothers to the East makes us laugh.
Our guest is Kevin Smuckler, if you've just joined us. And again, his new book is Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School. And actually, let me take this opportunity to invite those of you listening to let us know if you have reread something recently that perhaps you had read for the first time years ago and what your impressions were in the rereading, and particularly if you had any sort of experience where suddenly you were awakened, to use the word that Kevin uses, about The Band Played On. Boys of the Band. I'm confusing those two for some reason. What is it... for example, that you would like to reread, perhaps that you haven't, and what book can you say that you reread and had a totally different experience with it? I'd actually like to throw those questions out to you, and I know that listeners should have some real light to cast on this in terms of their own experiences. And in fact, let me invite you to join us now. We'd like to hear from you on this, and you can call us now at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. And also join the conversation on our website and Facebook page, or email us, forum@kqed.org. We want to get you involved in this conversation, though. Kind of wicked side to you, Kevin, when you're talking about Bartleby to Scrivener, a classic short story by Melville. You say, I'd like to leave it on a desk of an office worker and then follow through by spying on that person. This is a bit perverse. And those of you who don't know the story about Bartleby, he just keeps saying, you know, the most famous phrase of all, I suppose, in all of Melville, other than call me Ishmael, and I prefer not to. And he says that over and over and over again, and becomes sort of really catatonic for all practical purposes. So this is a little bit the imp of the perverse in you.
I do have that. I think I mostly see myself as a kind of wholesome, corn-fed Midwesterner, but I get it from my father, who is a sort of proud iconoclast, and he believes that anything that carries the hush of reverence probably deserves a few noisemakers blown in its ear, and I do feel that way about the classics. I feel like one of the great things we can do with the classics is be a little playful with them. And
well, you say the Scarlet Letter. You say, yeah. I don't like it. I mean, you're upfront about that. And you would think it's the book that most high school students who had to read would never want to go back to again.
I do say that. It's funny. I had the essay about the Scarlet Letter is called The Scarlet Letter. I didn't like it either. The either meaning I had probably four dozen conversations with people about the books I was reading for practical classics.
Reminds me of a poem by Marianne Moore. I too dislike it.
Exactly.
The poem is called Poetry.
And they said, oh, never, never again. I hope you're not doing The Scarlet Letter. And so I reread The Scarlet Letter, and I didn't like it then, and I don't like it now. And the reason it's one of the 50 is because, to me, it's a stand-in for the act of difficult reading. I do believe not every book is supposed to, you know, give us a hug and serve us cookies and milk when night falls. I believe some books are supposed to infuriate us, and some books are supposed to lift us up and throw us down, and some are supposed to make us sad, and some are supposed to make us vengeful, even.
But The Scarlet Letter has an enormously important lesson in it about what I think it was Sartre called the negative path. That mm-hmm. is, Hester Prynne goes along this negative path, sins, and has to wear the Scarlet Letter and is a pariah and so mm-hmm. on. And yet she becomes a much stronger, better, mm-hmm. richer, internally person as a result of that.
Oh, absolutely. I don't deny
that. In that sense, it's kind of an allegory or a parable of great weight to it.
Yes. And oddly enough, there's a good amount of Hawthorne that I like very much. Rappaccini's Daughter is one of my favorite short stories. But The Scarlet Letter and I were just not meant to be friends. I feel like it's like a made hospital bed. It's perfectly constructed and the corners are nicely folded off, but it just does not want me in there.
Well, you don't like his writing either, I noticed. But you actually shudder every time you read Shirley Jackson's Lottery. We're so inured to violence these days and to horrors that one would think reading the Lottery maybe the second or third time wouldn't quite have that. But you say you shudder every time you read it.
That may just mean I'm more fragile than the average person.
Or but more sensitive.
Or that too. Thank you. But yeah, I find it is so simple and so plainly told. It's a bit like I think the phrase I use is like looking a rat in the eye. It's just there's something I think that was the phrase I used for that book. There is something so deeply bone chilling about it. And it never has not been, even though I've probably read that story 10 times.
That's also true about another story that you mentioned, which is Joyce Carol Oates' Where Are You Going? Where Have You Been?
Oh, yeah.
Which was made into a terrible film called Smooth Talk. And in fact, you say it's her best story. I'm not sure about that. But again, it's a story that teaches youth about youth and teaches adults about youth.
Absolutely. I don't think I say it's her best story, but it is the one that Joyce Carol Oates herself says, when I'm dead and buried, that is the thing people will most remember me for. It's just her best known story. I think it was much more it was obviously much more timely when it was published because it was in reference to a recent criminal case that had happened shortly before the story was published. But yeah, I think as a book about parents and children, as a book about growing up and the danger of not knowing your own capabilities when you're younger, I think still chills me to the bone, that story.
All right. What have you reread, and what would you think maybe you should reread? And we'll get some listener feedback here. Let's start with you, Steve. Hi.
Hi. Hi.
Hi, Steve.
I wanted to say something about two books that I think are fantastic and very, very, very serious novels. First of all is a classic from Herman Melville we were just talking about. Moby Dick, and I had read that book when, well, I read parts of the book when I was much younger, but it wasn't until my late 30s that I picked up the book and decided to actually take it seriously and read it for what it was, from cover to cover, including everything, you know, all the things that people even pass over, you know, in their reading of the book. And I found it to be one of the most inspiring and intellectually stimulating and exciting novels that I had ever read, and probably one of the best books that's ever been written. And it certainly propelled me forward to reading much more of the classics. I had never really actually picked up the classics before in my younger years.
Excuse me, Steve. I think Moby Dick is a wonderful example. A lot of kids read it and they think there's a lot of whale blubber and stuff to get through in there.
Flensing.
And then suddenly, you know, they read it later on and realize just how extraordinary a novel it is. Yeah,
it is. It is extremely well written, and it is funny, and it's also really it calls upon a person to really examine themselves, and I think that is the mark of truly great literature, is when you can read something and find yourself within that novel, and be mesmerized by the eloquence and the beauty and the poetry of the language.
Well, you speak certainly in glowing terms about it, but I'm looking at my screen here, and I think you were going to mention a novel that I think is terribly underrated and really needs to be read more, Malcolm Lowry's Under the Volcano.
Oh, yes. Another one of my favorite novels. Under the Volcano definitely spoke to me very, very, very much. And it came at a time in my life when I really needed to hear, well, not hear, but see.
Were you drinking, Steve?
I was waiting for someone to ask that.
No, I had come from a family of alcoholics. Mm-hmm. And so I certainly understood the misery and the devastation of alcoholism in its full capacity, and I understood really where the story was going and how it spoke.
But had you read Under the Volcano and Moby Dick? Well, you said Moby Dick you'd read earlier. Had you read Under the Volcano earlier?
Actually, it was Under the Volcano that I read first, and then I decided that I needed to take up some serious stuff and took on Moby Dick.
Under the Volcano is not serious?
No.
Okay, Steve, thank you. Good to hear from you. Let me hear from another listener, and that's Ken. Hi, Ken, you're on.
Hi, I wanted to mention 1984, which I reread. Fascinated with how much of it seems to be true. It was kind of shocking to me.
Speaking about 1984, somebody listening in on you? It's a lot of noise there. Do you know what the difference was, the years? You were in high school, and when did you read it again? How many years later?
I read it in 1990, and I just reread it last year.
Uh-huh. Well, thank you for that. We're going to hear from some more listeners on this, but I just want to read email from a listener named Michael who says, after finishing Practical Classics, that's Kevin's book, last night, my faith in any literature's relationship to humanity is renewed. Even the lightest readers have favorites, will defend them, and possess an unwavering hatred for other works, all of this becoming a culture's conversation about itself and with itself.
Oh, that's nice. Now I'm going to have to ask all my friends named Michael who was responsible for that.
Here's Kim who writes, every great story has already been told, and we do well to remember that. Did you like The Hunger Games? How about Divergent? There are great modern-day dystopias, but except for their female heroines, not much different from 1984 or Fahrenheit 451. The classics are important because they tell wonderful stories and do it exceptionally well. Many more recent works are fantastic, but if we're being honest, derivative. All right, on that note, we're going to go to the break. We'll come back with our guest, Kevin Smokler, and we'll talk about what you've read and reread and what kind of effect it had on you. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to the Forum program. I'm Michael Krasny. The great literary classics are more than merely important works of art, says author Kevin Smokler, who's here with us this hour. Books that have stood the test of time should also provide insight into, quote, how to live a great life. And in his new book, Practical Classics, he advocates rereading those often assigned books like Candide, Huckleberry Finn, I Know Why the Cagebird Sings, and we're talking with him. And we want to hear from you about what makes a book worthy of revisiting, and what have you reread, and what kind of experience was it to reread it? And I should mention that Kevin Smokler will be appearing at Copperfields Books in Petaluma tonight at 7 o'clock, and at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park Thursday, May 23rd at 7:30 p.m. If you have something you'd like to add, we'd like to hear from you. You can call us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free, 866-733-6786. And you can also join the program by going to our website or our Facebook page or emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Let me go to more of your calls, and we'll go to Mark in Pleasanton. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Thank you for a very interesting show and for taking my call. I have a question. I wonder why it is that so rarely, or essentially never in my experience, is a discussion of great classics of science fiction really ever included in various conversations about classic books. I, for example, reread every few years the Dune series, Asimov's Foundation trilogy, even Jules Verne, and I find that those books provide many of the same enduring themes regarding the human condition, hopes, aspirations, geopolitics, emotions, relationships, you name it, as most of the classics that we typically put on our top 50 or top 100 lists.
Mark, I don't know what Kevin has to say about this, but I must tell you, a former colleague of mine who unfortunately passed away this year, George Tuma, taught a course in science fiction. And we used to talk about the fact that science fiction, there is a kind of snobbery about science fiction in literary circles or in English departments and those who revere the canon, wouldn't you say, Kevin?
Oh, absolutely. It was very important to me, Mark, in this book, in Practical Classics, to make sure that I wasn't being uptight about what precisely a great book looked like. And what sort of clothes it wore. So I have Fahrenheit 451 in this book. I have the Sherlock Holmes novels. I have Art Spiegelman's Mouse. It was very important to me that things we call genre books, big air quotes this time, were not sort of cast aside simply because we throw that term around arbitrarily.
And if I may say so, Left Hand of Darkness is about as good as it gets.
Oh, indeed.
In terms of American literature. Thank you, Mark, for that. In fact, here's a listener who says, I attended a cheap California public high school, but we were assigned many more truly classical era books and plays than appear in Kevin Smokler's table of contents, which makes me wonder, is Euripides now too radically feminist for U.S. teens? Is Thucydides now too anti-war? Is Sophocles too anti-authoritarian for the United States? Anti-authoritarian, excuse me, which has the highest per capita prison population in the world? Or is the real problem that in a country like the U.S., which teeters pathologically close to religious fundamentalism and in which the military-industrial complex is our most consistent contributor to the GDP, teachers don't dare assign books that prove a polytheistic society was in many ways more civilized, not to mention more democratic and self-critical than ours?
Wow, that's a mouthful. I didn't touch the ancient Greeks for this book, and it was for rather simple reasons. I only had 10 months to do it, and I figured I could dive into the ancient Greeks and never come out. So it was largely I largely had to draw some boundaries at the very beginning simply because of the vagaries of the publishing industry.
Another listener writes, as a counselor educator, I revisit these classics and integrate them in my classes as a sort of bibliotherapy. For example, when focusing on non-judgment in the counseling relationship, I share the narrator in The Great Gatsby, who says so eloquently that his father had great advice. Whenever you feel like judging someone, realize they haven't had all the advantages you've had. I share, for those who are not familiar with this, that in fact, that's Swiss Fitzgerald's brilliance, the ability to see a situation objectively like privilege and how counselors, too, need this vantage. When I share with students, people essentially tell us their stories. They are struck by the connection of literature. And, of course, I get a few folks reading.
Oh, that's great. That's great. That's the word practical was super important to me to have at the beginning of this. I want people to feel that great books aren't merely to be read, but they're to be lived along with and used, too.
And here's Beth, who writes, back in the early 80s, I came upon an old set of Harvard classics, which we still have, all 51 volumes. It's interesting because there were 51 recommendations in the last hour. We talked about the report on the Oakland Police Department. They're used all the time since we are a homeschooling family. Then when our oldest was around 10, he and some friends started playing Dungeons and Dragons, and this opened up a whole new area of interest in art, architecture, food, agriculture, and various other topics of past centuries. Yet it was all those Harvard classics he had read and would be reread by others that helped them in the game and in tutoring others on what various classic literature had said of the times.
Oh, that's great to hear.
And another caller, April, good morning.
Hi. I was lucky enough to teach freshman English for a couple of years in the Bay Area, and I was rereading books that I was totally disconnected from when I was a student and rereading them over and over and over again with my classes. And what breaks my heart is that, especially for freshman English, so many wonderful books are kind of lost on that young age. And so when me and my fellow teachers would try to convey that Atticus Finch is our very serious literature boyfriend, they didn't get it. And so it was just heartbreaking. To Kill a Mockingbird is just fabulous, and every adult should reread it.
I'm going to actually read an email from a listener named Michael, if I may, April, who says, like many, I first read To Kill a Mockingbird in high school. Shortly after my father died, I learned more about being a man from Harper Lee's book than anywhere else. 4 decades later, I continue to read To Kill a Mockingbird at least annually to remind myself of the man I yet want to become.
Yes, thank you, April. It's my hope that with Father's Day coming up, that people give To Kill a Mockingbird as a gift, because the essay I write in Practical Classics is all about how To Kill a Mockingbird would make a great Father's Day gift, because Atticus Finch is nothing if not an example of great fatherhood at work.
And integrity.
Yes.
And John from Antioch says, I usually don't reread books because I feel that I won't get as much out of a reread book as I'm going to get out of reading something new for the first time, but I have reread a few. The main one I recommend rereading is Henry David Thoreau's Walden. I think the first time I read it, I wasn't quite prepared for it. It's a pretty hard book in some ways. 10 years later, when I reread it, I felt I got a lot more out of it, perhaps because I had grown a lot in that time, and more importantly, my reading comprehension had grown much.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say it helps to have some of the romantic mist removed from your eyes when talking about Walden if you read it as a teenager. We know that Thoreau actually walked himself back into town to have his mother do his laundry while he was hiding out in the woods for a couple of years.
Those are nice little choice facts that you seem to add throughout your responses to the 50 classics that you take on. Let me get another caller on here. That's you, Paul. Hi.
Hi. I'm Paul. Well, I didn't so much reread a book as I read a book, Malcolm X's autobiography, when I was about 22. And 10 years later, about 8 years later, I ended up founding a nonprofit here in East Palo Alto to help get kids and their parents off to an early start in their pre-kindergarten years. And I have a poster of Malcolm in our office on the wall because it was so inspiring to me and really ignited my passion to help people to get ahead in life.
Well, thank you for that. And thank you for bringing that to our attention. In fact, just occurs to me that, you know, kind of a sad coda to the whole Malcolm X story is the fact that his grandson was just killed.
Absolutely.
In fact, in a kind of shootout of some sort in a bar in New Orleans. We asked our Facebook page what books you've reread, and just give you some of the replies. Debbie writes, Gone with the Wind and Little Women, period pieces for all ages. Ramin says, For Whom the Bell Tolls, 5 times so far. It crystallizes the 20th century. Kim says, Most relevant to current events are mid-century works of dystopia, like Fahrenheit 451, 1984, Animal Farm, even The Stepford Wives, even ironic utopian works such as Thomas More's Utopia, Machiavelli's The Prince, or Plato's Republic are applicable to modern times. And Paul says, Great Expectations. It's so multifaceted that every time I read it, I think it's about something completely different than what I thought the time before.
Oh, wow.
Eva Marie, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. Professor Krasny, I quickly want to say from one teacher to another, your programs broaden my mind and are balm for my soul.
Thank you.
C.G. Jung is what I read practically over and over again for the last 40 years. Carl Gustav Jung.
Oh, wow.
Does that include the red book?
It includes the red book, although I must say I am more into the writings of facing yourself in the mirror and adding another light to it.
Very good.
Yes, yeah.
And I thank you for the call. Here's China says, Durrell's Alexandria Quartet. Read it when I was 28, reread it when I was 45, and was surprised how much it had shaped my views of women and relationships. Reread it again recently at 65 with more detachment, but with perhaps a little more emotional and social intelligence. Very rewarding. I don't know if Lawrence Durrell is read as much as he used to be read, but, you know, he used to read the quartet. It was almost de rigueur to read that back in the day. Well, you may want to weigh in here, by the way, and if you do in the time remaining, our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also join the conversation on our website or our Facebook page or email us, forum@kqed.org. David says, I just reread Auntie Mame, and I'm amazed at how well the humor holds up 60 years later.
How about that?
How about that? Chris writes on our website, what about books on audio? The reader has full autonomy, the listener has less. No, audiobooks are some sort of hybrid experience involving literature, but it is not reading. And so tone of voice and attitude, etc., is presumably imparted by the voice as opposed to the reader. Kevin, I don't know how about you. I've said many times on the air, I don't listen to books. I don't want to say that in any snobby way. I just don't find it as fulfilling is actually engaging with the written word.
No, I'm kind of the same way. I also happen to be a complete addict for radio, so I feel like that takes up the majority, that takes up the space in my mind for listening, and books occupy a different room in the house, which is...
That's well said.
Yeah.
Kaya tweets, I think Gatsby is so overrated. Snooze. You know how H.L. Mencken described The Great Gatsby?
No, tell me.
An anecdote.
It's if you ever want a good laugh, take 5 minutes and go to Amazon or Goodreads or any place where books are commonly rated and look at the ratings for books that are as ubiquitous as The Great Gatsby or Catcher in the Rye. There's about 200 one-star reviews of both of those, and overwhelmingly written by high school students. Who,
it's always the case, though. Yeah. I mean, with any book, you know, when I started writing books and I got, you know, mixed reviews on Amazon, I thought, what's this all about? Why am I getting mixed reviews? And the fact is, I realize that everybody gets mixed reviews.
Oh, yes, yes. There's no such thing as universal acclaim.
Let me get another caller, and that's you, Steve. Hi.
Hi. I think you shortchanged recorded books. If you listen to an Elmore Leonard book, I can't remember the guy's name, but there's no other voice you will ever hear connected with the sleazy characters in his books. Or for that matter, that's a side point. What?
No, but that's why. That's one of the reasons why I think I avoid them. I want those voices to be in my own head.
Well,
I mean, I know that may sound, you know, strangely possessive, but that's the way it is.
Well, there are voices that are better than any that have appeared in my head.
Likewise, but I want it to stay there, yeah.
Okay, so let me make one brief correction. It isn't Durrell. I mean, it isn't Durrell. It's Durrell. I heard him correct the pronunciation to Dick Cavett years and years ago.
Well, thank you, because I've always said Durrell.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, well, most people do. I was going to say Moby Dick because a professor you may have known, Dorothy Overly from Sonoma State, who wrote the first doctoral thesis on Thoreau,
Melville.
Faulkner,
said
before a class that I was in, she had read Moby Dick 24 times and didn't understand why her students didn't get it. She got something different out of it every time she read it. And what students were complaining about that day was having to read Conrad, which someone in class said was rather like wading through mud. And Dorothy's response was, yes, but wasn't it rich mud? You read it slowly and chew on it. It's such wonderful language. So that's my vote for the moment is Nostromo.
Well, thank you for exercising your franchise, Steve, and I appreciate hearing from you. And listener writes on our website, I love how honest this guy is about Hawthorne, but seriously, Scarlet Letter rocks.
I didn't write Practical Classics to establish some sort of set of stone tablets as to what everybody should be reading. It's only my opinion, and the endeavor here is with the exception of the mild critique I give to the Scarlet Letter, is a 100% positive one. I consider myself the world's biggest fan of the act of rereading.
And by the way, the listener who tweeted that Gatsby's overrated says that when I survey my students, it's their least favorite read, but that's at Cal. That's not high school. And let me go to more of your calls, and we'll welcome Peter. Hi.
Hi, Michael. Thank you very much. And to guests, The Road Less Traveled popped into my mind, and as a social philosopher, I'm realizing that my appreciation for his little section on problems.
Excuse me, Peter, do you have a degree in as a social philosopher?
Actually, my degree is in peace and conflict studies from UC Berkeley, but I've dwelt on the philosophy of peace. And it occurs to me that responsibility is really at the root of peace, because that translates into sustainable freedoms. And that translates into sustainable creativity, productivity, prosperity, and so on. So Peck takes the time to explain to us that most problems can be solved if we take the time to address them. And I think many people just take their hits in life and then go on and just drop it and don't take the time to do a service for others. And that's really a social disease. And if we could get over it, the whole society would improve. My other enthusiasm was for Robert Frost, Two Tramps in Mud Time. And the conclusion specifically, yield who will to their separation. My object in living is to unite my avocation and my vocation, as my two eyes make one in sight. Only where love and need are one, and the work is play for mortal stakes, is the deed ever really done for heaven and the future's sakes.
All right, good recitation. Yeah. Thank you for that, Peter. And we're talking to Kevin Smokler. His new book is Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School. Genevieve says, I've reread Little Women many times, first as a peer of the youngest daughter, Amy, now as a peer of the mother, Army. That says it pretty well.
Oh, absolutely.
We'll go to more of your calls. From Orinda, Sarah, we welcome you. Good morning.
Hey, I can't wait to buy your book and give To Kill a Mockingbird to my husband for Father's Day.
Oh, thank you so much. That's really nice of you to say.
So I think it's really interesting to read as a grown-up, I'm 55 now, books that I liked as a child or a teenager.
Mm.
And I'm thinking, for example, the Narnia books, which I reread every few years, the E. Nesbitt books, which C.S. Lewis used to read all the time as a grown-up, the Tolkien books, you know, all our favorites. And it's almost like a little time travel aspect, because you kind of can remember or try to remember what you liked as a child. Maybe now, as the previous caller said, you identify a little bit more with the grown-ups than you do then. And it's really interesting over and above enjoying the book.
Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned that. You know, I included in here The Phantom Tollbooth by Norman Juster, which my editor originally said, do high school students really read that? Isn't that more like a fifth grader's book? And I said, perhaps so. Doing it corresponded nicely with the coincided nicely with the 50th anniversary of The Phantom Tollbooth. And I also read an interview with Norman Juster, who said about 70% of the fan mail he gets is from grown-ups saying some version or another of, I get the jokes now. And I think The Phantom Tollbooth is one of the great advocacies for learning and adventure being one and not two things that are separate from each other.
Let me thank the caller. Yeah. And Casey tweets, The Giver. I reread it about 10 years after it was required in seventh grade and still found it as interesting and disturbing as I did before. Mm-hmm. Carol writes, read the science fiction from the 60s. You'll be amazed how right on those works are. And Ben says, two books, Giovanni's Room by Baldwin was so powerful for me as a young gay man and now as an adult is so human. Slaughterhouse-Five by Vonnegut, stylistic choices that make me think of modern-day PTSD and a great anti-war novel. Mm-hmm. James says, I would like to get Mr. Smokler's take on the electric Kool-Aid acid test.
Oh, I'm afraid it's been way, way too long since I've read that. That probably should have been one of the ones I included here in Practical Classics. I love Tom Wolfe. I'm more fond of his nonfiction than of him as a novelist. And I don't think the electric Kool-Aid acid test is the best thing he ever did, but it's sort of the beginning of where we saw Tom Wolfe begin to emerge.
That's also a place to find some nostalgia for that. We're talking about going back in the 60s and all
even,
of it.
Yes, even though he stands at arm's length from it and is deeply critical of it, too.
And then we go to Maria. Maria, join us. Hi.
Hi. I'm from San Francisco, and originally I come from Central Europe.
Mm.
And when I was a teenager, and I don't think it was a school assignment, I came across Thomas Mann, and my favorite book of his is The Magic Mountain.
Oh, yes.
And I think it's mainly because it is so appropriate, even now, about war and philosophy of various kinds and people talking and very, very intelligently outline the tragedies that wars, and especially World War One and Two.
Magic Mountain is a wonderful book. I must tell you, though, Maria, that There are works by Mann that people don't know or read, like that classic, that are also terrific.
Oh, I know. I read all of them.
Dr. Faustus, for example, yeah. Or the story Tanya Kroger.
That's right. But to me, I think one of the reasons that Magic Mountain is so special is because when I entered the United States, I was still a teenager, and I was sent to Ellis Island until they decided what to do with me because they were going to send me back because I had a spot on my lungs.
Mm-hmm.
And there comes Magic Mountain back again.
Oh, back to consumption,
being
to tuberculosis.
Being a Davos, Switzerland, you know, and it's absolutely fascinating the way he puts political and philosophical and just storytelling together.
Well, thank you so much for that. Good to hear from you, and we'll hear from some more listeners. Let me go to Howard next. Howard, join us.
Hi, Michael. Thank you. Great show. Thank you for doing this. I was a voracious reader as a teenager, but I was a boy. And so I have a 10-year-old daughter now, and I've reread recently the Anne of Green Gables series and Pride and Prejudice. And I just wanted to comment that getting to read it through the eyes of my 10-year-old daughter gives me a completely different perspective, especially on the female characters in those books. And it's been an absolute revelation and absolute joy.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. And I want to remind you that we're talking to Kevin Smokler, who will be appearing at Copperfield's Books in Petaluma tonight at 7 o'clock and at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park Thursday, May 23rd at 7:30 p.m. And you're listening to Forum, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. We want you to know that if you want to find out more information about how to support this radio station, which we would urge you to do and hope that you will do and continue to do, until your mortality runs out, simply go to kqed.org and I'm Michael Krasny. Let me go to more of your callers, and let's go to Oakland and welcome Bob. Good morning.
Hi, Michael. I've always enjoyed your show. I liked Benvenuto Cellini's autobiography. And I read it quite a while ago, but the more I learned about it, the more I was interested by it, because I thought he was a braggart in a way when I first read it, and I thought it was kind of a he told a lot about himself and the people around him, and I didn't know how true it was. But the more I've learned about it, the more accurate it is, and I think it's now claimed as really a very, very truthful, first time I talked to the radio, a very real depiction of the people and the times without glossing over anything, all the foibles, all the good, all the bad. So I've always enjoyed that book.
Well, thank you. It's one I've not read. Have you, Kevin?
No, I can't say I have.
Do you find that you find more truth in fiction or in nonfiction?
Oh, God. Equally. Someone once asked me if I had to choose between books, movies, and music, what would I choose? And I replied, suicide. I don't think I could. I'm a nonfiction writer, so I think I read nonfiction with a slightly different hat on because I'm reading it for professional training as much as for enjoyment, but I enjoy them both equally.
Well, apropos, we'll get Neil on here who wants to talk about books as opposed to movies. Or Neil, go ahead.
Yeah, two questions. First, what's your opinion of Graham Greene as a novelist? The second is, does the movie version of a book help you clarify the book or understand the book a little better than you might have ordinarily?
I'll take Graham Greene. I'm a real rookie too. I think I've read the Power and the Glory, and that's about it. And that was a long time ago. So I feel like I need to come back to.
He's written a number of classics.
Yes, absolutely. The Heart of the Matter and the Quiet American. I just simply haven't gotten to. As the question of movie adaptations, I think movies can do a number of things for books. Of course, we know they can blaspheme a great book. We also know they can make a decent but serviceable book a classic, like Francis Ford Coppola did with The Godfather. We also know that they can cast a book in an entirely different light, like both Laurence Olivier and then 50 years later Kenneth Branagh did with Henry V. So a good movie can do a number of good things to a book.
Or it can ruin a book.
And it can ruin a book, of course, too.
To take Neil's question literally, I mean, it can also help illuminate things in the book if it's a good screenplay. But it's a different animal. It's a different.
It is. It's an adaptation is just that. I almost prefer it be called a transmogrification. It turns into something else entirely.
And thank you, Neil. A listener writes, my father forced my siblings and I to read 100 Years of Solitude when we were in middle school. Of course, we couldn't grasp most of the meaning. I had a mental block against ever reading it again. When I finally reread it as a young adult, it actually became my favorite book of all time. That's from Roberto.
A very special book, but because I only had 10 months to do this, I had to unfortunately leave aside books that were long family sagas and big family trees. I couldn't keep them all straight.
You had to leave aside a lot of books, obviously.
Yeah.
Tough choices, I'm sure. You could write a whole book about what you just had to exclude.
Yes.
Aaron is our next caller. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. I'm such a big fan of you guys, and this is such a compelling show. But my 17-month-old daughter and I, we read a ton, and it's really fascinating rereading stuff with her that I thought of as children's books and getting something new from them. And particularly, we're just wrapping up the Jungle Books 1 and 2. And what I'm getting from them now versus, you know, I always loved them and had a great impression of them, but wow, just a whole different ballgame.
Okay, thank you for that. Here's Sophie, who writes, I take offense at the guest comment that On the Road speaks more to boys and men while girls and women relate to the Bell Jar. I read both books in high school, and indeed parts of the Bell Jar touched me, but On the Road had a formative impact on me, and even today, 20 years later, there are moments when images from that book come to my mind. It holds a special place in my heart.
Didn't mean to say one was exclusive of the other. I think either gender could get as much from either book.
Diane from Oakland writes, recently I reread Steinbeck's East of Eden, had a totally different experience the second time around. Somehow I only focused on the twin brothers' lives in the first reading when there is so much more to it and so many characters, including Steinbeck himself and his sister.
Mm-hmm.
Gail writes, I guide two book groups who occasionally reread books we have all read years earlier. Two notables were Atlas Shrugged and Catch 22. In the case of Atlas Shrugged, most of us had revered this book either in high school or college. When we reread it, most of us intensely disliked the book. We found it trite, the character shallow and unlikable. What a surprise and a disappointment. In the case of Catch 22, most of us liked it, but not as much as we had when we first read it and felt it was a revelation at that time. Maybe it's the fact we're older and more jaded. It's harder to impress us. Well, however, I'll say that my 16-year-old daughter read Catch 22 for school and loved it, so there you go. Maybe age does make a difference in your reading perspective.
I think there are some books like The Catcher in the Rye, like Atlas Shrugged, that seem to have kind of a built-in self-destruct button that maybe you're not supposed to carry them on into adulthood. Although for practical classics, I did find something as an adult to get out of Catcher in the Rye.
Well, Kevin, it's delightful to have had you here. Good luck with the book, and let me remind listeners that the book is out and available, and the total title is Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School. Appreciate your being with us on Forum.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. You can continue these suggestions on the website that you have of books that you've reread, by the way, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Forum's produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.